From disaster to adaptation, how is Copenhagen tackling climate resilience? Hi, my name is Marcin Wojciech Żebrowski, and this is the newest episode of Urbcast, my podcast about urbanism, architecture, cities, and many more. In 2011, Copenhagen experienced a major flooding event that caused extensive damage and insurance claims. The incident resulted in over 90,000 insurance claims, with the value of the claims totaling 5 billion Danish crowns. The city of Copenhagen estimated that the cloudburst caused 6 billion Danish crowns of damage, which corresponds to around $1 billion worth of damage. This flooding event, or to be honest, rather we should say disaster, was a clear reminder of vulnerability of cities to extreme weather events and the urgency to invest in climate resilience strategies. Under a high-end climate change scenario, severe storms with intensities similar to the one in 2011 could occur every 40 years by 2100. This highlights the importance of taking action to reduce the risk of future damage and loss of life. Anytime someone asks me how it is to live in Copenhagen, and that probably it is an ideal city with all the bicycle infrastructure, happy people, and so on, I always like to use the Copenhagen flooding in 2011 as an example of a city that is not ideal. No city is ideal, each city has its own problems, and the case of Copenhagen and the flooding is a good example not only that all of the cities are prone to the climate change and challenges, but also how can you tackle those. And this is why today I will talk to my colleague Trine Stautskaart-Munk, who is a consultant who has worked with cities worldwide on climate resiliency and sustainability. Today we will focus on a significant event that occurred in Copenhagen in 2011, and also how the city with other different stakeholders tackled this huge disaster. Trine used to be a team leader and head of resiliency at Livable Cities department at Ramboll, and now works as global urbanism manager at Henning Larsen. She will share her insights on the vulnerabilities of cities to extreme weather events and the strategies that cities can employ to adapt to those challenges. We will talk about Trine's experience in developing the Cloudburst Concretization Master Plan for Copenhagen and the importance of addressing climate change adaptation in urban design. More to come will be about the role of data in tackling the climate challenge, and also how to mitigate floodings and what's the first step to that. Welcome to the newest episode with Trine. The big flood in Copenhagen, the huge cloudburst that happened in 2011, it was a topic that I think it's really important when you talk about Copenhagen. And this is something that I really wanted to talk about in my podcast for a long time. And I feel like I found a perfect guest, a perfect person to share some thoughts about. So just to start, I wanted to say welcome to the podcast, Trine.
Thank you so much.
You are an expert if it comes to resiliency and also the stormwater management. And today I think that it is a good moment to talk about how can we implement those strategies if it comes to all the climate crisis challenges that we have around us. It happens also in Denmark. Do you remember where you were when this whole big flood happened in Copenhagen on the 2nd of July 2011? I think you were still studying.
I was still studying, and actually I was also traveling, so I wasn't even home to live it. But I heard stories about it and I saw pictures about it, and then I lived some of the other that came the years after. So I only experienced it on social media.
But I guess that you probably knew someone who was affected, because actually this huge cloudburst cost $1 billion of damage. So we can translate it into 6 billion Danish crowns, which is a huge amount of money. So I guess that it was like something that affected a lot of people.
Yeah, it basically changed the entire way we think about designing and planning Copenhagen.
Can you just tell us what was the main reason for that? You could think that Copenhagen is a city that has the access to the canal. So probably water just can just easily go to the canal and problem would be solved, but it wasn't in that case.
So I think actually the city of Copenhagen was already preparing a climate adaptation plan. So they were aware the climate is changing and it will affect the city in the future. But I think this really surprised them that it could happen this quickly and so intense and so focused. So it was a small area basically where you had the cloudburst, and it was a very unlucky area that turned into massive flooding also of major entry roads into Copenhagen. So I think they were already planning for this, but they were not planning for it to happen already and not at this magnitude.
Especially that this size of the rainfall that was experienced is something that happens once every, correct me if I'm wrong, 100 years maybe?
I think this one was even bigger, but yes. And that's how they started working with the idea of cloudburst, or skybrud, as we say in Danish. It's a short, intense rainfall that happens very locally, but basically you need to design the entire city for it to be able to happen anywhere. And for many cities, they would then look at the classical solutions of gray infrastructure. So big pipes underground. And Copenhagen wanted to do it differently. And I think they have been successful in pioneering how you can think again about stormwater as part of the entire water cycle and think of it as a resource rather than something that we need to get out of the city as quickly as possible.
It seems that it's pretty forward-thinking approach. We are discussing years, probably 2005, 2010, when the city was planning to have such an idea of the water retention. But so one can say that the flood, it just make things happen faster in a way.
It definitely did. And it also made financing more available. Mm. So often, unfortunately, we do need a disaster to see that funding becomes available to address this. Often we see it more like a reactive disaster recovery rather than disaster preparedness. So I think in many ways, you can say obviously it was a devastating event, but it also did actually accelerate action to prevent future events like that. And I think also it really transformed the way the city operates. So it was the first time that different agencies within the local government of Copenhagen got together to make a citywide plan to address the issue of flooding. And I think that has been transformative for many people in the government and also made the way we plan Copenhagen focus much more on where water wants to move or where water wants to go. And also looking firstly at cloudburst projects before we look at other construction projects in the city.
If it comes to the big flood that happened in the July of 2011 and all the damage it caused, was there someone that took the full responsibility for it? In other words, like, who is to blame for such an event? Is it something that, for example, the city council could be prepared for, or it was, in a way, unavoidable?
That's a really good question. I mean, unfortunately, there's some randomness in how climate change manifests. Mm. I think the city was actually preparing for something like this, so they could come out fairly quickly after this event and say, we're actually already working on it. And they have been working on it ever since. So I don't think we can look to see who we can actually blame. But I think the city did take responsibility, so did the utility HOFOR, and they've been collaborating since to address this as a primary focus area. But they also took on another responsibility to actually help cities worldwide address similar issues. So they've been introducing this way of thinking to New York City, to Buenos Aires, to DC, and I think that is taking on more responsibility than they actually needed. But I think that's again showing how they're pioneering this new way of thinking.
I think that the sharing lessons of challenges that have been solved is a very good brand mark for Copenhagen.
Yes.
And we discuss here, of course, the climate adaptation, but we can say the same about the bicycle use and how
yes.
the cities are more designed towards the bicycle urbanism. Way. If we stay a bit more in the topic of the flooding in Copenhagen, because this is something that I refer to a lot if someone asks me to share what I like in Copenhagen or some stories or some background behind Copenhagen and its success as a city, I very often refer to that because it is such a huge game changer, such a huge challenge that in a way Citi managed to overcome. But it was such a huge one that I really think that a lot of willpower was needed. So if we talk about like going forward after this huge disaster, you said that there are many different agencies, many different actors. Was it because the responsibility for Citi being developed and more resistant towards such an event, is it just like a kind of common shared responsibility for everyone?
I think the notion of climate change is complex. And that's also the reason why I got into the whole topic in the first place. I'm really drawn to complexity. And I think everyone realized that we can't address climate change by planning how we have planned the last 50 years. So they needed to involve a larger group of stakeholders. Also, the whole idea of handling stormwater on the surface rather than pipes and looking at, okay, so all the investment we'll now put into new stormwater infrastructure, could we make it benefit more people if we do it above ground? And that's where you see all these skating rinks or lowered soccer fields that, you know, 99% of the time, it's a recreational space. 1% of the time, or maybe even less, it's floodable. And I think that is really where you saw that you needed all these stakeholders. So because we use the urban space and we fight for urban space, is it a sidewalk? Is it a bike lane? Is it, you know, for cars or whatever? We needed both the traffic experts, we needed the water experts, we needed the urban planners, we needed someone from schools and so on. So it really became a complex process and a very integrated and strategic planning process. And I think that was new. And that's also where Copenhagen started breaking down some of the planning silos that you typically see in local government all over the world. And I think they did it really well in actually getting the right people at the table at the right time to develop a plan like this.
So you got interested in the climate adaptation before the flooding?
Yes, I did. So I have a master in geography from University of Copenhagen. I graduated in 2013, but most of my master's, I focused on climate change. At the time at university, it was a lot about obviously melting glaciers and focusing in on Greenland, but it was also the first baby steps to look into climate migration, desertification. So arid regions or semi-arid regions becoming more arid, especially the Sahel region in Africa. So I was on a field trip to Burkina Faso where we looked at the access to water and how that's being reduced. And also a lot of focus on equity and already at that time, gender studies. So often when we talk about resilience, it relates to water. It's either too much water or too little water. It's basically a water balance that's being disturbed. And we see more of the extremes, extreme drought or extreme flooding. And often it's the ones that have the least to actually address this or prepare for it that are more affected. And often also the ones that have the least to do in creating the problem in the first place. Mm. So I also had a semester in Buenos Aires in Argentina where I studied gender studies and human rights because I realized for climate change, the equity issue just gets even more exacerbated. And that doesn't really matter where we are in the world, whether we're in the US or Southeast Asia. It really is the vulnerable groups that will be facing climate change to a level that we can't even imagine here. And so I was studying that when the cloudburst happened in 2011. And that kind of got my focus to Copenhagen. And I got involved in the climate adaptation work here in the city. My master thesis was with the local municipalities around climate adaptation. And then when I graduated, I was already at the time working in Ramble as a student assistant, but then I was full-time hired into working on these climate adaptation projects with the municipality of Frederiksberg and Copenhagen.
And you've been actually working in many different places around the world, spending a lot of time in the US as well. The problems there, the challenges you worked with in the US and also different places, were they anyhow different or it was all about maintaining mostly this water balance?
So I would say many of the problems are universal. And I think that's also why it makes sense that a city like Copenhagen shares their lessons learned from this process, because the problems are similar and often the conversations are the same. So in Copenhagen, a lot of the conversation around this new way of handling stormwater in nature-based solutions or blue-green infrastructure, on the surface, the conversations often ended up talking about maintenance, which is not a very sexy topic. But to local government, it is a huge cost on the budgets and a real concern. So when we change the urban scape, we also change how we maintain it. And then different agencies and within local government needs to agree on who pays what and how do we then maintain it. And that conversation is universal. So when we go to New York City or we go somewhere else, it's often the same conversations we have, either about maintenance or safety or co-sharing of costs and benefits. So I think we can say that a lot of the challenges that we see in relation to climate change are really manifesting in the same way. Mm-hmm. Government is also almost always siloed in a way, to some extent or another. So I think we can really translate a lot from Copenhagen to others. Then when we deep dive, everything is unique. You know, every single space needs a tailor-made solution. Mm. So it's not to say that we can just copy-paste what we did in Copenhagen somewhere else. Because, you know, the governance structures are different, financing mechanisms are different, and so on. But when we talk about strategic conversations, they are very much alike.
Coming back a bit to Copenhagen, you said that you are also attracted by the complexity. And the complexity is something that I think it might be a huge challenge on its own. When we talk about Copenhagen and this adaptation strategy, we talk about the city of Copenhagen, and we also talk about this Copenhagen Utilities, HOFO, but also other actors that were involved. So for example, Rumble and back then Studio Dreisaitl, and probably many different architecture offices, many different agencies. But I still would say, especially comparing with, for example, Berlin that I've been to recently, that Copenhagen is rather a small city if yes. You look on the map of Europe or the world, of course. So how this complexity and how those relations looked like in Copenhagen, and what lessons could you basically share with the other cities taken from here? In terms of how did it work in here in Copenhagen, where you still had, I would say, reasonably small amount of stakeholders versus probably 5 times more in different cities, in bigger cities?
I think in that sense, Copenhagen is a thankful place to pioneer something like this. Also because, for instance, just the whole utility aspect, for many other geographies, each utility is owned by a separate private company. Here, most of it is public. It simplifies the process. There's also a high trust in government here. So when we move into something like this, generally the public is in favor because they believe that the local government is doing what is right. In many other geographies, when you pioneer something, if there's not trust to government, it's really difficult to even just get the first baby steps in a good way. So I'll say that obviously it's a darling place to work. And I think that's also the response when we introduce something like this to New York City, they're like, yes, but you're a small country, you know, it's much easier. And the response we've given is that, yes, that's true. And there's also a high level of trust, but the processes are the same. So the thinking is the same. And that mindset change that happened in Copenhagen needs to happen regardless of size if you want to address stormwater in the future in a similar way. And that change, for instance, we see now in New York City, that they are looking at using the public space to become more multifunctional, more floodable. They also think more in equity and try to figure out how they can prioritize their actions and so on in a similar way that Copenhagen has done.
What happened also after the flood is pretty impressive, because there was this so-called master plan for the cloudburst. Mm-hmm. And it happened, wasn't it, like just 1 year after?
Yeah, it moved really fast. But the city was also already working on it. So
that's why.
Yes, I think if this had come completely unprepared, you wouldn't be able to respond this quickly. Mm. Yeah. So in that way, the city was in a good place to actually create some action. And I think another good story from Copenhagen is also how they looked at risk reduction and how they communicated that to lower the insurance premiums for Copenhageners, and also managed to change national legislation to actually let the utility HOFO co-finance a lot more of these surface-based solutions instead of pure piping. So I think there were a lot of successes. I'm sure there's also a lot of failures, but in terms of lessons learned and so on, I think there's much that other cities can learn from here. And I think another thing we should talk about more openly is also failures. But it's a tricky conversation, even in Copenhagen, but much more when we move to other geographies where accountability is already a sensitive topic.
Definitely. I would love to develop the topic of the failures, because this is also how we learn. That's something I experienced in my own life, that I learned the most from those events. Yes. But also just developing a bit the thought about this Cloudburst master plan for Copenhagen. So there was like a huge challenge in front of you, in front of people involved, to propose a vision and a concept that would be basically easy enough to basically implement pretty fast, right? To just prevent similar occurrences like this flood in the future. And I found that those all visions and concepts became boiled down into three master plans covering more than half of the 300 projects in the two cities, I mean, Copenhagen and Frederiksberg. So two cities, but Frederiksberg is kind of within Copenhagen for those of you who are not living here. So could you just say something more about how did you work with this master plan and how basically you translated those visions, studies, discussions into the action, into the on-surface water management systems, parks, which we, I hope, mention as well, and other solutions?
Yeah, it was really a whole new way of looking at the city. So it was very much about welcoming water back into the city. Initially, also historically, because of hygiene issues, we wanted stormwater quickly out of the city. And now we wanted to create space for it. So instead of only looking at the city as defined by land use, we looked very much into the topography. So thinking about where water wanted to go and where we could store it. So looking at public space as possible storage areas for stormwater, and then figuring out how we then get it to the recipients afterwards, typically the harbor for Copenhagen. That was a whole new way of looking at the city. After that had been done, then we started working with different stakeholders to detail these projects. So you can say it was the process of looking at really big scale to understand the topographic catchments and dividing the city into catchments rather than administrative boundaries. Each of those catchments then got their own concretization plan, we called it. And I think there are seven of those. And each of those then got broken into individual projects that are now being rolled out over a series of years. And throughout that process, you had heaps of stakeholders, and you had architects, you had engineers that all needed to be brought to the table in the right time to make the decisions needed. And there was also, before this, a whole business case developed that looked at what is the current and future risks in Copenhagen in relation to stormwater-driven flooding. How can we translate that to socioeconomic monetary values? And what does that mean for a business case? And then they looked at different levels for protection, or you can say new design storms to actually direct the size of the solutions that we proposed for the city. So we could design for a 20-year storm or a 50-year storm or different water depth. And the business case showed that the best solution was the 100-year storm projected. I forget if it's 2080 or 2100, but projected into the future. So a future 100-year storm. So that's what all the projects were sized to. And just thinking about designing for the future in this way in the urban space was new. When we look to other cities around the world, a vast majority of them still design all infrastructure and buildings to historic climate data. And obviously, when we think about the generations that will live in these spaces, we need to also think about the climate that they will be living in those years, and make sure that the infrastructure and the built environment is designed for that.
How big of an ally is data nowadays? Because you've mentioned that we need to be careful with the old data in the cities. And I think that a good example of that is a flood that happened in a Polish city of Wrocław, which was also like the biggest such an event in Poland. It was, I think, in 94 maybe. And I think that one of the reasons was also that, of course, data was not as developed, all the data measurement devices and so on. And also they've used some old data. And then the flood that came, it was way, way, way bigger than they were expecting. So it turned, of course, into a huge crisis as well, into a huge catastrophe. So coming back to the question, the role of data, do you see any development of the tools that we can use nowadays?
Yes, for sure. I think a fundamental aspect of how the city of Copenhagen was also able to deal with this is that they had already created what we call a hydraulic model. So basically a model of the entire sewer and stormwater network for the entire city that we could use as a tool in this process. Many cities do not have that. Even in the developed world, the data relating to infrastructure is scattered. The land use data can also be really bad. We're working in Washington, D.C. now, and they're not updating the land use data. So we can't even get building footprints that reflect how the city looks today. And I think hydraulic modeling is becoming more important in terms of how you want to address this. If you don't have that, you honestly don't know what your how your hazard or how the rainfall will manifest in the city. And it is not as simple, well, you can say simple, but when we talk about storm surge or flooding from rivers and the sea, we understand that there's some kind of barrier. And when that breaks, it kind of overflows. It's a little bit simpler. We can do a lot simpler analysis to understand that hazard. But when we talk about stormwater, it's so complex because it moves in and out of the existing infrastructure pipe network and pops up on the surface and then disappears and so on. And we need to model this to actually understand where are the hotspots that we need to address. And often cities skip this step. And then they do some simple analysis. Okay, there's a depression over here, looks like flooding, something like that. Or they address the issue after the water is in a stream or river and basically build walls around those streams and rivers to make sure they don't overflow, instead of looking at where is the water coming from in the first place and could we retain it upstream. We've been working with the U.S. Army Corps in the U.S. on thinking differently about how they could do that. But even the models they use are not complex enough to give a real overview of the stormwater flooding issues. So I think this idea of modeling the complexity of the water is becoming increasingly important. And that tool is fundamental, I would say.
And this is something that could be implemented into the design as well.
Correct.
You've also switched on the way basically from working with resiliency in Ramboll to now Henning Larsen.
From engineers to architects.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I was wondering how your thinking changed seeing the design as a driver.
Yeah. And it's actually something that we're still very much working with here in Henning Larsen, is trying to understand how can all this technical knowledge become design parameters for the built environment or for the urban form that we're shaping. And it is really two different languages. So when we talk to the engineers, it's a completely different conversation and a different language than when we talk to the architects. And it's something that we still need to bridge that translation gap, you can say. But it's also where there's a high impact potential. So the minute we crack the code of how we can easily digest all this modeling, the hydraulic modeling, the climate resilience analysis, all these things, and turn them into actual design parameters for architects, then we'll see a transformation. And I think we're really moving forward right now on that, but there's still much to learn. Also for me, there's something about how we do design that we can't do like we used to do. And we can't use yesterday's processes or solutions to solve tomorrow's problems, right? So we need to create more space actually in our process, more time, more space for other experts that we typically didn't even invite to the design process. But now they need to become part of it. And where should they be in the process? And which questions should we ask them? And which outputs that they create are actually really important to us and which ones are not? So there's a lot to learn still in how we integrate more technical knowledge into the design phase.
I promised before that we'll also come back to the topic of failures and challenges and the things that did not work well. Can you share maybe one biggest problem, a mistake, a failure that you remember through this whole process of tackling the situation after the flood in Copenhagen in 2011? And it's, again, I'm asking because it's the best to learn from mistakes, right?
Yes.
And it's best if it's someone else's mistake.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm not sure I have a good answer for it, but there are a couple of reflections for sure. I think in Denmark, we could have asked much more of the private sector. So if you look at a city, it's not completely publicly owned, at least not in Denmark. And for many other places in the world, the private sector is actually fundamental in addressing issues like this and using the public's or using the space we have in the city to address this. So we need water to go somewhere, and sometimes it wanna go on a privately owned lot. So how can we actually create incentives to get the private sector to care about this? And there are some good examples from Copenhagen on public-private partnerships and so on. But I still think the responsibility of the private sector is much bigger than what is being recognized or asked of them right now. And that's a challenge we see all over the world. Why should the private sector care about resilience? What are the incentives or arguments to get them more involved? And the other thing I would say is also the community aspect, and especially the justice aspect. So us accountable for creating the problem in the first place need to figure out how we can then amend this in relation to those that will suffer more from climate change. And in Copenhagen, equity might not be a huge deal, but we look at other areas in the world and it's really exacerbating very, very critical situations even more now. But some of the tools that we use do not reflect that. So when we talk about climate risk, we often refer to infrastructure damage. And when we look at low-income communities, it's not high-risk areas because the infrastructure is not expensive enough. So New York City, you do a climate risk analysis and it will show you Manhattan is where you need to start, instead of showing you that the kiosk owner in Southeast Queens will lose his entire livelihood. He's not insured, he won't bounce back. You know, it's not really taking those kind of considerations into the models. And I think we need to be much better at doing that so we can also have equity be embedded in the entire technical analysis. And that's something we've been working a lot on in Rambl. Have a couple of research and development projects that are still undergoing to understand how social vulnerability can become an official part of the processes. So I would say, I think the equity piece is where we're still failing. I think it becomes very quickly about infrastructure damage. And that's also super important. But I think also we learned from the recent COP. Now we'll see some kind of, yet to see the model, but basically some accountability in terms of financing climate adaptation in low-income areas or vulnerable communities. And then we need to figure out that we do that in an equitable way.
It just shows me how the climate change and adaptation is so closely tied to the social aspect of it. And we can't discuss one without the another. To summarize, I would love to ask you for at least two more things. If there was a one thing that we could do now to mitigate floodings in our cities, what would it be? So in other words, what could be this first visible step?
We as in citizens, or we as in government or designers?
I would say especially, I know that this podcast is listened to by different people who work both in the private sector, in the public sector, in the city councils, municipalities. But I think that I would mean that we as citizens mostly.
Yeah. I mean, for many, there's not much we can do about this unless we live in a house with a huge backyard or something like that. But basically, the idea of retaining stormwater on your own property, if you are able to do that, you won't create flooding downstream. So those are also some of the incentives that Copenhagen has tried to roll out to provide financial incentive to disconnect from the existing drainage network and retain your stormwater on site. It's not necessarily accessible to all, either because you live in an apartment or you live very downstream in the catchment or whatever. So I think it's difficult to ask or answer what we can do, but I would maybe say that it's something that we need to all think about. And maybe instead of thinking about how we can solve flooding, maybe it's more a question of how can we look at our lifestyle and make sure that we do what we can to not create more climate change in the future. But yeah, but that's a whole different conversation.
Oh yes, yeah. That's for another episode. To give some more advice, what book on the topic would you recommend to the listeners?
Actually, we have teenagers at home that also care or are concerned, to be honest, about the future. So recently I read a book called A Field Guide to Climate Anxiety that I liked a lot. And it basically helps us figure out how we can talk about this giant issues that we can't really solve ourselves, But how can we then do little things and maintain sanity throughout this process? And I really like that also because it gave me some tools to talk to my teenage daughter about climate in a good way. So I can definitely recommend that book.
Thank you. I think that if a kid or if a teenager can understand something, then it's written in a good way. And I think we should stick to those. Thank you. I think that we developed this topic. I also learned a lot. And thanks for sharing this background behind the big event, the big flooding in Copenhagen in 2011. And I think that also, thanks to your work and all different actors, it will not be as drastic if it happens next time. And I think it might happen again because of the climate change,
unfortunately,
which is advancing. But I hope at least that we will take some steps to mitigate it and make it less harmful, not only in Copenhagen, but overall in many different cities around the world. So yeah, thank you very much for sharing.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for listening to the newest episode of Urbcast. I hope you enjoyed it. If you think that it was a useful knowledge, please share it with someone who can also appreciate it. If you would like to get to know more about Urbcast, please visit the Urbcast website, Instagram, Facebook or LinkedIn profile. I added links to all of them in the episode's description. Feel free to reach out to me or to Trine if you would like to develop this topic further, or maybe if you are a city representative that struggles with a problem of flooding in your city. Thank you and talk to you soon.